Moncrief on News Talk.
Mentioned this man that Irish people know very little about, a man called Irish captain James Fitzmaurice. He was from Laois and he piloted the first east-west Atlantic crossing in April 1928. So much so, this was such world news that US President Calvin Coolidge at the time sent a message to the Irish government saying, "I wish to express to you, as well as to the people of the Irish Free State, the great admiration of myself and the people in the USA for Captain Fitzmaurice's share in this magnificent flight." How can we not know more about him? To tell us more is Dr. Patrick McCarthy, Senior Lecturer in Public Policy at Munster Technological University. Patrick, how are you today?
Good, Tom.
How can we not have heard of this man?
That's a tough question. I suppose for quite, not quite a long period, but a period of his life, his working life, he wasn't in Ireland, you know, after that historic flight. In 1928, he went to the States and he was in London until probably, so he was away quite a bit in the 30s and 40s he came in. But again, you're correct. I suppose he's certainly famous, but also forgotten in many respects, considering the feat that he achieved.
Right, because what he did was fairly amazing, isn't it? We often talk about the flight from west to east, Charles Lindbergh's, but going in the opposite direction was more difficult, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. The east to west flight path is a lot more difficult. Weather, prevailing winds, and that. Even today, now, if you're flying to America, the flight over is always maybe could be an hour longer than the flight back. But the flight back is always that bit shorter with prevailing winds coming from the west.
Right, and in his day, in the type of aircraft he was, that was more like 10 hours longer, really, wasn't it?
It was absolutely a hell of a lot longer. The whole flight, and that particular flight, a 38.5-hour flight.
Holy.
From Baldonnel all the way to Newfoundland, where they not quite crash-landed, but landed anyway, eventually.
Right. So who was he, Patrick? Where did he come from?
A very interesting character. He was born in Dublin. His father was a prison officer in Mountjoy, and he was born near Mountjoy and then ended up moving to Port Laois when he was about 3 years of age. His father was transferred to the prison there in Port Laois. That was in the early years of the 20th century. He was reared all his life in Port Laois. He went to the local CBS. He went to Rockwell College. Then he went along and became a draper's apprentice, which he hated, ran away from it in many respects, went and joined the British Army, joined the Irish Volunteers first, around 1912, 1913 there. And then when the Irish Volunteers split up, you know, because of the issue with participation in World War One, he followed the Redmond side and joined the British Army at underage. And his parents were very, very annoyed. So they got him back out of the army. But within months, he was back in the army again. So he survived the Somme. He fought at Arras there in 1917 in France. Then he became a cadet into the newly formed the Royal Flying Corps, as it was at the time. It was courted to the RAF. So he became a First World War trained pilot, but he never saw action because the war ended. But he stayed then in the Army, in the Air Force, I should say. And then within a number of years, he was back in Ireland. He joined the new fledgling Irish Free State Air Force, Air Corps, and he was involved in the Civil War, dropping leaflets. They only had a couple of planes, and they were fighting against anti-treaty forces, obviously. And so he remained in the Air Corps. He was based in Fermoy for a number of years. There was an aerodrome in Fermoy, an old British Army aerodrome. That was closed down in 1924. He was transferred up to Baldonnel. And he had this huge interest, obviously, in the east-west flight, because the west-east one was, as we know, that feat was accomplished in 1919 by John Alcock and Arthur Brown when they landed in Clifton in Galway.
Sure.
So he attempted it with a British pilot, Robert McIntosh, from Baldonnell in September 27. But again, the weather was against them. They got off the west coast of Ireland, but they were forced back. And they had to land on Bell Strand outside Ballybunion in North Kerry. So within a number of months, two Germans, German nationals, Baron Gunther von Hunfeld, he was a wealthy German aristocrat, a lot of money behind him, and his compatriot was Captain Hermann Kohl. He was a decorated German World War I pilot. And they arrived in Baldonnell, again, to use Baldonnell as the base, because it was the most obvious place to try it, because it was obviously the most westerly land point in Europe. Baldonnell was the only base at the time, the only active base that they could operate from. And Fitzmaurice then, as colonel, or as one of the officers in Baldonnell, he got official permission from the Irish government at the time. But the official permission was at his own risk.
Right. They must have thought their chances of getting across. God, huge risk taking that flight.
Massive risk. Massive, yeah. Massive. Huge. And
right. So off the three of them go anyway.
Yeah, they took off in April. They took off in April and off they went. And in fairness, they were well prepared. There was quite a few trial runs in the weeks preceding the flight. And off they went with on the Bremen, which was a Junkers W-33 aircraft, German aircraft.
Yeah.
They had 530 gallons of aviation fuel on board, and off they went. And The whole kip and caboodle was about 5 tons in weight, which was quite a bit, you know.
Imagine trying to get that yoke off the ground with those engines in those days. Piston engines. Absolutely. Good luck with that.
Unbelievable, yeah. But they were cruising. They only cruised at an altitude of about 1,500 feet, really, in it. And because they obviously wanted, the higher they went, the tougher it was going to be with winds and stuff like that. So their airspeed was about 120 miles an hour, which again wasn't huge, really, when you look at it.
And, it's like a flying car, really.
Yeah, you know, and everything was going fine for the first 2,000 miles. But then bad weather kicked in mid-Atlantic, and then more trouble developed then when the compass failed on the Bremen. And then they had to fly blindly, and they used an old traditional guide, which was the North Star, and that guides them towards the westerly direction, and they came in towards the coast of Newfoundland. That's where they were heading, and but eventually they more trouble kicked in then when they plane suffered a major oil leak. And as we know, when oil starts coming out of an engine, we know what can happen. It can stall. So lucky enough, they managed to reach a remote lighthouse on Greenlee Island. And Greenlee is just off Canada's coastline there between Labrador and Newfoundland, and just up from the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So they successfully landed the Bremen. They suffered damage when they were touching down. Then the islanders came to them, rescued them, and took them to the lighthouse keeper's house, and that was it.
And this is absolutely huge news. The New York Herald Tribune run the banner headline, Victory. I mentioned US President Calvin Coolidge sending a message to the Irish government and the New York mayor as well. It's a big deal for the Irish Free State, isn't it? It's the nascent Free State.
Absolutely, it was huge. It was huge, and they were feted right across America, and they came back to Ireland as well. They got the freedom of New York. They were given distinguished Flying Corps medals. They were the first foreigners to be given them by the American president, by Coolidge in Washington. And they got ticker tape parades all over America, tourist cities. And again, interestingly, at all the parades, Fitzmaurice made sure that he had the tricolour with him at all times. And he always wore his uniform as well.
So relatively soon after independence, that would have been so important for the Free State. Yeah. He died in 1965 at the age of 67. And there was a Glasnevin full military honours. So he was remembered at the time.
He was remembered, and fittingly, he got a state funeral when you consider really what he had achieved. He was the last of the three. Von Hohenfeld died within a year of that famous flight in 1928. He died of cancer, and then within 7 or 8 years, about 10 years, 38, then Kohl died. Kohl had taken up a job with Lufthansa as a commercial pilot, but he fell foul then of the Nazi regime, and he basically gave up with Lufthansa and went and to a farm, his own small farm there in Bavaria. That's where he died in 1938. So Morris was the last of those three famous men.
Wow. What a fascinating story. It's amazing we don't hear more of it. Patrick, thank you very much for sharing that with us today, Dr. Patrick.
You're more than welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.